about the truth behind the birds, that they were stolen, he continued, as I rooted through my backpack for the folder of evidence. How many birds did he send in total? I really can't remember, but I think it was like 3, maybe 4. The story hewed suspiciously close to what Edwin had told me. It wouldn't have been difficult for them to coordinate their story, but then again, they might have overlapped because they were both telling the truth. I pulled out all the screenshots I'd taken of Goku's activity and began to read the exact date and time of each post. Flame Bowerbird, male, full skin. Indian Crow cape for sale. Purple-breasted Katinga skin for sale. Long interjected to say that he'd never physically held those items, that he'd only been creating the posts on Edwin's behalf. But I reminded him that Edwin already had an eBay account, a website, and knew how to make posts on the forum. Why on earth would he need your help? I asked. It doesn't make sense, I think, he said in a chastened tone. I battered him with questions about each sale, asking who bought what, but Long said he couldn't remember anything, including whether it had been he or Edwin who received the money. You would remember, though, wouldn't you? I'm not trying to be an asshole, but you would remember. These things were thousands of dollars. Don't you think you would remember? Ren, still perched on my shoulder, was getting agitated. I don't think I sold things for thousands of dollars, he said. What I remember most is selling small amounts, like packages of feathers. Did he send you those to then mail to buyers? I don't remember. Rin started shrieking so loudly my ear began to ring. I was getting frustrated. Long's reputation had been grievously tarnished by his association with Edwin. Jens, his erstwhile mentor, had shared with me the email in which he cut ties with Long, whom he viewed as a son, over his involvement with the stolen birds. He'd been called everything from Edwin's fence to the mastermind behind the heist. How could he have forgotten the details about the event in his life that had cost him so dearly? I spent 4 years trying to forget all this, he said, sensing my mood. You're trying to bring it all to the surface. It's really hard, though, because I'm trying for so long to just put this behind me. The details are quite unclear to myself because I'm trying to close this case. Yeah, me too, I muttered. Edwin told me that you were one of the first calls he made after he got arrested. Searching for a different way in, I asked. What did he say to you? He told me everything. Then I realized everything I've been doing. I thought I was helping a friend. Instead, I was really shooting my own leg. I thought I should be nice to Edwin, being very naive. But it was like totally backstabbing a friend. The worst thing you can do. What he did was horrible. Long told me he mailed the few skins he had back to the Tring shortly thereafter. After realizing how his posts might be construed, he panicked and began to erase his digital tracks. That's why I deleted all the posts on the forum, because it seems like I've been behind the whole scenario, he said, but now recognized that it only made his involvement more suspicious. He had a forlorn look. That was totally idiotic. Bit by bit, over the subsequent hours of the interview, his memory yielded small confirmations. He remembered receiving money through PayPal, which he would then forward to Edwin. I asked if Edwin paid him for this service, and he admitted that he'd received some feathers as payment. Just as the community of fly tyers engaged in bidding wars over exotic birds, he too fell under their spell. He wanted blue chatterer and Indian crow feathers so badly that he hadn't stopped to think clearly about how a student flautist had come to possess so many rare skins. I read from the transcript of my conversation with Edwin, in which he blamed his arrest on Long, blaming him for talking indiscreetly about the birds he'd received. I hadn't yet discovered that Edwin was mistaken, that it wasn't Long who had blown his cover, but rather the Dutchman, Andy Bocholt, who had shown a suspicious bird to Irish. I glanced up to find a wounded look on Long's face.
What should I feel? I didn't know this until now. He never mentioned that it was because of me that...
He trailed off.
I don't feel bad, he said,
as though he were trying to convince himself.
I feel sorry for him. I don't support his actions, but I support him as a friend.
He spun in circles, alternating between anger and hurt. In his wounded state, I brought up the topic of the missing skins once again.
Many people would probably think that I possessed those skins,
he said quietly. Why?
Because I was closely related to Edwin. That would be a natural thing to assume.
Do you have them?
No.
How can you prove it?
I can't prove it.
Then the question becomes, where are they?
I don't know.
But how is that possible? I said in exasperation. How do you not know?
You and Edwin. I don't know because only a tiny part was sold through me. The rest he was selling not through me.
We sat in silence. The sun had set hours ago, and the groceries he'd purchased, pasta, a bottle of wine, vegetables, and ingredients for a Norwegian brown sauce, were all still in grocery bags. The last train back to Oslo was imminent. 10 hours after I'd arrived, we shuffled down to the station, my head aching, my voice hoarse, and my stomach racked with hunger. As the train charged noisily into the station, he turned to me with a serious expression and said,
Look, I know the hand I played.
The doors slammed shut before I had a chance to follow up. I had no idea if I'd ever see him again. On the way back to my hotel in Oslo, I mulled over what he'd said. If this was an admission of guilt, it wasn't cathartic, either for him or for me. If it was a declaration of innocence, it wasn't very convincing. I made quick work of the hotel's unfortunate minibar, cans of chili nuts, chocolate bars, and vinegar potato chips, chased the ensuing stomach ache with Ambien, and went to sleep. I was roused from my slumber by an early morning phone call from the front desk informing me that a Mr. Long was waiting for me in the lobby. Bleary-eyed, I descended to find him perched on the arm of a sofa with a concerned look on his face. As we headed out in search of caffeine, I realized how shaken he had been by the interview. He said he was thinking about giving up fly tying, but was worried that the friends he'd made through the hobby might not like him anymore. He kept asking me questions about how to live an ethical life, and whether it was possible to be both environmentally conscientious and a citizen in the modern world. Hadn't I negated a lifetime's worth of recycling simply by flying to Oslo? He asked. Hadn't the animal that yielded the leather in my belt suffered? What about eating meat?
Long, I'm not sure this is a question of animal welfare. We're talking about a felony heist of dead birds.
He nodded gravely. As we wandered around Oslo, I sensed he felt that now that the interview was behind us, we could just hang out, maybe even strike up a friendship. Given our discussion of animals and skins, I couldn't resist ducking into a storefront that had a decadent display of furs. Inside, a large taxidermy polar bear was frozen on its haunches in a menacing posture. A mounted baby seal stretched out on a nearby table. The manager, an elegant woman with ink-black hair, looked at the two of us skeptically. We didn't appear as though we could afford what she was selling. In the corner of the shop were 8 shelves stacked with polar bear skins, 10 in total. The smaller females were $25,000 each. The larger males started at $50,000. I stood in front of the largest skin. The bear's jaw opened wide, teeth flared. As a rug, it would take up 15 square feet. When I told the woman that I was an American, she scoffed and said there was no way I could bring a polar bear home now, thanks to Walter Palmer, the American dentist who had paid $54,000 for a guide in Zimbabwe to help him find a lion. When news broke that Cecil the lion had been lured out of a sanctuary, shot, decapitated, and skinned, Palmer became the most hated dentist in the world.
"You'll never get it through customs," she said,
pronouncing customs with a sneer. Back on the street, I was annoyed. Between Long's question about the environmental impact of the flight I'd taken and the discussion of Palmer, there seemed to be endless ways to rationalize bad behavior. Palmer had blamed the guide for luring a protected beast into the sights of his bow. Edwin had said he stole from an institution and not a person, an institution that he had concluded was no longer participating in any meaningful scientific research. Long had said he simply trusted a friend, never questioning how a fellow student suddenly came into possession of such priceless skins. Now he was wondering whether meat eaters inflicted greater ecological damage than fly tires. If any fly tires had doubts about whether the feathers and skins they had were from the Tring, they eased their consciences by deciding that the museum's tally of missing skins was only a guess, and an incorrect one at that. I wanted someone to step forward and claim responsibility, to own up to their actions. We walked around the Akerbrigge neighborhood, at the heart of which is the Thief Hotel. Even though he clearly hoped the interrogation was over, I couldn't resist reopening the topic. "What was so great about your friendship with Edwin that you decided to stand by him after everything, at such a huge cost to your reputation?" I asked, referencing the public allegations on Facebook. He shot me a pained look. "I thought that's what being a friend meant." At the same time, Long admitted he didn't know Edwin all that well. When I asked why he would risk so much for someone he wasn't even all that close to, he exclaimed,
"I idolized Edwin. He was the best tire of our generation. So when he asked me to help with raising money for a new flute, I was proud."
"You saw it as an honor," I volunteered.
"Yes, very much."
That night we went to a dinner party with four Norwegian fly tires, feasting on fresh-killed venison, clams, and aquavit. The more time I spent with Long, the sorrier I felt for him, and the angrier I grew toward Edwin, who must have sensed his friend's vulnerability and exploited it. He had involved Long in a crime without his knowledge, asking him to handle stolen goods, to accept and forward payments for illegal materials at a time when he knew that British law enforcement was searching for them. Even during our interview in Dusseldorf, long after he'd escaped the grip of the law, Edwin still seemed content to let clouds hover over his friend. On my last day in Norway, though, I woke up in an ornery mood. Somehow the purpose of the weekend seemed to have slipped from my grasp. Over some 20 hours of interrogation, Long's role had shrunk from mastermind of the Tring heist to unwitting victim, a vulnerable kid with abandonment issues whose ultimate crime had been to trust someone he shouldn't have. But I hadn't made any progress on the question of the missing skins. Even if Long had been naive enough to believe Edwin's various fictions about the origin of the skins, he seemed frustratingly forgetful about the precise number of birds and feathers that had passed through his hands. Had I been played? Had he preyed upon my empathy, supplying me with another version of events that I was all too ready to believe? I liked him. I wanted him to succeed in life, to emerge from this mess a better person. I didn't want to unleash Adele or Interpol agents on him. But I had a nagging feeling that something had gone unsaid, and I wouldn't be content until I knew what it was. He offered to meet me on the front steps of the National Gallery. 21 years earlier, on the first day of the 1994 Winter Olympics, when the nation's attention was on Lillehammer, thieves had leaned a ladder against the gallery, climbed through a window, and made off with Edvard Munch's The Scream. In its place, they left a postcard with a handwritten note. "Thanks for the poor security." For years, Paul Enger, the ringleader, hid the masterpiece in a secret compartment in his kitchen table. Long was in a chipper mood and made small talk as we headed down the street in search of lunch. I listened half-heartedly, but eventually lost patience and erupted, "I think you've been honest with me, Long, but but it feels like you're still holding something back. There were so many steps to this. He sent you the birds, skins. He sent you feathers already prepared in bags. He sent you the photos. He asked you to mail them. He asked you to take the payments and forward the money to him. I stole a glance at him. He was looking down at the pavement, hands in his coat pockets, as cars and strollers whizzed past. Even if you were a trusting person and looked up to Edwin, I continued, it seems like there were so many steps where a reasonable person would say, what is going on here? And you're not a dummy. You're a very bright, talented person. After a pause as long as a city block, he spoke.
I feel like there shouldn't be any reason to believe me, because it sounds too illogical. His voice was soft. I feel like just being in that situation is so hopeless. I'm not holding anything back, but it feels like being trapped inside this cage. It doesn't matter what I tell.
No, I shot back. Nothing's hopeless. It does matter what you say. I've heard from two people in the last year, for example, that you've told them that you have tons of Indian crow. And I don't know what to make of that, whether to doubt what they're saying or doubt you. I'm just trying to
extract the truth, he offered quietly.
So what am I supposed to do with that knowledge? I asked.
You do whatever you need.
But is it true?
Yeah. He seemed to be shrinking before my eyes, his voice growing fainter, his pace slowing.
You have a lot of Indian crow?
I still have some of the packages of the ones I was supposed to sell.
He had opened the door a crack, and I came barging through. How many?
110, maybe.
Birds? I exclaimed.
No, just feathers.
What are the species? I asked, trying to keep my composure.
Granadensis, Pyroderus gutatus gutatus, Pyroderus gutatus occidentalis. I think it's around 110. It could be around 100 or 120.
But we're in 2015 now. What did you have 4 years ago? He was clearly in agony. I knew he was hungry, but I kept flogging us forward, nixing his restaurant suggestions, unwilling to let anything interrupt the moment. He sighed.
It's really hard to just number because there's a low number in each package, and I didn't count those packages, like how many packages and how many feathers. I don't remember how many were sold. I think maybe I sold half of them, and then I had half the packages.
I knew he had a number in mind, and that he was fighting like hell not to mention it. Finally, after much prodding, he estimated the total number of loose feathers at between 600 and 800. We stepped into Arakataka, an upscale Nordic restaurant a mile or so from the gallery. Under any other circumstances, eating at a place like this would have been a special occasion. How many chances does one get to have fried cod tongue or cabbage and razor clam? But Long was in the process of admitting something he'd never told a soul. And the act of telling me meant letting go of a narrative he'd been embracing for years, that the community of fly tires had unfairly maligned his reputation by accusing him of involvement with Edwin. He was coming to acknowledge the uncomfortable truth of what they said at last. The waiter was walking away with our order when I leaned forward and asked, for maybe the 12th time that weekend, how many skins Edwin had sent him to sell. For the first 2 days, he'd held firm at only 3 or 4. But in the wake of the admission, I had to ask. How many skins, Long? Was it 10? Or was it 50?
It was between 10 and 20.
His voice barely audible over the Norwegian pop music.
But definitely nothing like 50 skins.
I leaned back in the booth. Depending on the species, the value of 20 skins could be anywhere between $20,000 and $125,000. If the feathers had been plucked and sold retail, the number would only climb. The value of 800 Indian crow feathers, presumably part of his payment from Edwin, could top $7,000. His eyes were worriedly searching mine for some kind of reaction. Long, you know you have to show me them, right?
Yes.
The weight of the admission pressed down upon us, dimming the world beyond our table. I looked up and saw tears streaking down his cheeks. Embarrassed, he excused himself and hurried off to the bathroom. When he finally returned to the table, our waiter cheerfully appeared with our feast, placing a large crab with a pitiful hole cracked into its shell before me. Long stared down blankly at a plate of monkfish and hake. Neither of us had much of an appetite. I thought back to Edwin's bravura performance in Dusseldorf, how he'd emphatically declared that Long was in no way involved, but then grinned when he acknowledged that the case against his friend looks bad. I remembered that Edwin had reached out to Long immediately after our interview, suggesting that he speak with me. "What did Edwin tell you to say to me?" I asked. "Did he tell you to lie to me?"
"He said that you're not my friend, that we shouldn't become friends. He said we don't owe him anything, and that I should get you to pay for all the food and everything."
I laughed. "Where did you hide the feathers before I came?"
"I just had them in a box."
We barely spoke on the train back out to Oscar. While I was about to see what I'd spent years searching for, what I felt was not triumph, but concern. What would happen to Long if I told Adele about his involvement? It was pitch black when we got off at Bondavon Station. He dragged his feet as we made our way through the woods, as if I might change my mind, or a meteor might strike and relieve him of the need to show me the feathers. Halfway up the path, I asked him how he felt. He stopped to catch his breath. He was in good shape, but in this moment he was exhausted.
"I feel empty."
He emerged from his apartment with a small stamp album. It had a translucent gray cover with some Japanese writing on it. Our plan was to walk to a bar somewhere in Oscar to look through it, but I couldn't wait. Under a street lamp just outside town, I opened it up to find feathers arrayed like stamps, 5 rows per page, with plastic sleeves protecting the plumes, which glittered like tiny orange, sapphire, and turquoise gems against the black background. The first page alone held over 50 Indian crow and blue chatterer feathers. I tried to mask my exhilaration as I pulled out my phone and took photos of each page, keeping a rough tally of the feathers. As I turned the pages, I thought of the chain of events that had led to this moment. Hundreds of years of specimen collecting, a youthful love of fly tying that had mutated into something disastrous. The meticulous plot and heist itself. The chance encounter with Spencer on a river in New Mexico. At the same time, I realized that I was looking at a minute fraction of what was still missing from the train. Altogether, they might have amounted to only one bird's worth of feathers. I handed him the album. As we headed off in search of a pint, I asked him how it felt to show them to me.
"I haven't felt this bad since my mom died," Long said after a lengthy silence.
He said he didn't even feel comfortable looking at them and wanted to get rid of them. He asked if I could take them with me and return them to the train. I smiled. I had hoped to leave Norway with a suitcase full of bird skins, with tags attached. As much as I would have enjoyed sending the album to the museum, I declined, saying that the decision was his to make.
"What will the museum do with them?"
he asked hopefully. "Probably nothing, honestly. They're going to put them in a drawer, and they'll sit there until long after we're gone." Chapter 24. Michelangelo Vanishes. Months after my return, Long wrote to say that his grades had plummeted. Since the interview, he felt as though his life source had drained away. and he was ashamed that he had become so obsessed with something that had such a dark side. But when I asked if he'd sent the feathers back to the museum, he said he hadn't yet found the time. I was beginning to worry that he wouldn't break free from their pull. Even so, I wasn't going to notify Adele about my discovery. Long had made his share of mistakes, but it bothered me that he seemed to be suffering the consequences of the train heist more than Edwin himself. Edwin had used him, setting him up as a fence, so that anyone digging into the crime would find a great big X marking someone else. Why else have Long make posts to the forum on his behalf? Why send feathers and skins to Norway for Long to ship them to his own customers? Why ask Long to handle payments through his own PayPal account, if not to set him up as the fall guy? There was no other way to interpret Edwin's actions than as creating a smokescreen, implicating a friend who idolized him while he took the money and ran. What kind of person would do this? In the aftermath of my interview with Long, with Edwin's actions seeming so transparently calculated, I was even more skeptical about the Asperger's diagnosis. Could he really have faked it? My first attempt to speak about it with Dr. Simon Baron Cohen fizzled quickly. He told me that, for obvious ethical reasons, he could not discuss details of the case without Edwin's permission. But when I asked him if, in theory, someone could fake Asperger's, he replied that the diagnosis ultimately relied on clinical judgment. "There is no biological test of autism," he wrote. "This means, as with any psychiatric diagnosis, that in principle someone could fake it by providing false information in answer to a clinician's interview questions. But even then, clinical judgment and experience, is the person lying, comes into play." Baron Cohen was asking me to trust his judgment. But after reading a copy of his report to the court, which was leaked to me from someone close to Edwin, I found basic errors, that Edwin had not been motivated by money, and that he didn't think he had done anything bad in taking the stuffed birds. Baron Cohen's misreading was perhaps the unavoidable consequence of a single evaluation. I'd spent years building a timeline of the crime. The Cambridge psychopathologist had met him for a couple hours. Or perhaps it was an unavoidable consequence of the squishiness of the diagnosis process itself. In his report to the court, Baron Cohen buttressed his diagnosis by citing Edwin's scores on the adult Asperger's assessment. But there was ample reason to doubt the validity of answers to questions like, "I find it easy to work out what someone is thinking or feeling just by looking at their face." In a 2011 Nature article, Francesca Happe, a cognitive neuroscientist at King's College London, voiced her skepticism of Baron Cohen's diagnostic tool. "Whether those self-perceptions, as with any of our self-perceptions, are accurate is questionable." Baron Cohen's advisor, Uta Frith, echoed Happe. "Rigorous studies are still missing. At the moment, he has people saying, 'Yes, I'm a person interested in details,' as opposed to actually observing them on tasks." 2 years after the diagnosis spared Edwin from prison, the American Psychiatric Association expunged the disorder from the fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. The controversial shift, dropping Asperger's as a standalone disorder, only 19 years after it was included in the previous edition, happened in large part because studies revealed little consistency and how the diagnosis was being applied, according to The Atlantic's Hannah Rosen. After extensive review, the authors of an Archives of General Psychiatry report found that children with similar test scores were given different diagnoses. Whether a child was labeled as having Asperger's or diagnosed instead with autism or some other developmental disorder depended mostly on the clinician's somewhat arbitrary interpretation. In an op-ed about the decision to drop Asperger's from the DSM-V, Baron Cohen wrote, "Psychiatric diagnoses are not set in stone. They are man-made, and different generations of doctors sit around the committee table and change how we think about mental disorders." I sensed that I was coming to the end of the road. Edwin was no longer replying to my emails, and the truth about Long had been revealed. But as thrilled as I was to lay my eyes on Long's album of feathers, I knew that I hadn't yet solved the mystery, and that the bulk of the Tring's missing birds were still out there. In a final search for clues, I combed through more than 1,000 pages of transcripts of all the people I'd interviewed over the years, but I found that I couldn't stop thinking about the one person close to the story who had so far eluded me. The Tring's curators told me their suspicions initially fell upon the Québécois tire Luc Couturier, after discovering an email from him, dated 2 years prior, asking whether the museum would be willing to sell a number of their Indian crow skins. They declined, offering to sell a high-resolution photograph of the bird instead. It was an unusual enough request that they mentioned it to Adele in the early phase of her investigation, but she ruled him out as a suspect. In Dusseldorf, Edwin had told me that his former mentor, whom he described as the Michelangelo of fly tying, had not only been inside the Tring's bird vault at some point in the 90s, which the museum disputes, but had first encouraged him to visit the museum. At one point in the interview, Edwin said he'd sent Long some skins because he thought his friend deserved them for his flies. I wondered, had he also sent some to Couturier? My suspicion mounted as I trawled through Couturier's inactive LinkedIn account and noticed that he was connected with Dr. Paul Sweet, the bird skins collection manager at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. I fired a note off to Sweet, who revealed that in April 2010, Couturier had asked to be granted access to the museum's collection of birds of paradise, catingas, and Indian crows. When the curators asked for a reason, Couturier's response, "to refine my knowledge and test some of my hypotheses," didn't pass scientific muster. He was denied entry. I messaged Couturier in the forums, but his account hadn't been active for years. I pried an email address from another tire, but never heard back. I befriended other Couturiers on Facebook in search of him, but he seemed to have vanished. The only other person I could think to ask was John McLean. When I reached him, he was holed up in his basement, dyeing feathers and sorting orders from across the globe. The last time he'd seen Couturier was the 2009 Somerset show, where he'd arranged for him to share a room with Bud Guidry, the administrator of ClassicFlyTying.com, who was hoping to keep travel costs down. Couturier had a reputation for being erratic, so when Guidry reported that Couturier had stolen his credit card and run up $1,000 in charges that weekend, McLean cut ties with the French-Canadian. To find him, McLean suggested I reach out to a friend of Couturier's named Robert Delisle. Before long, I was clicking through a massive Facebook album of exotic birdskin photos. In one, there were 5 catingas, all in perfect condition, arrayed like a fan on Delisle's tying bench. In another, a full Indian crow skin with cotton eyes. In another were dozens of museum-quality skins. I sent him a message asking if he could connect me to Couturier, but Delisle told me he was no longer reachable. Couturier, he shared, lost his job in 2010. Over the past few years, Delisle had spent $40,000 buying up every last scrap of material from his hard-pressed friend. After selling off his rare skins and feathers, Couturier was no longer tying flies. Was there a lot of Indian crow and catinga? I asked eagerly, while Marie-Josée, who was born in Montreal, corrected my French. The details appeared on the screen one line at a time. Couturier had 10 Indian crows, 5 Western tragopan, 3 resplendent quetzals, 2 gymnogene bustards, and all of the chatterers, referring to the 7 species of blue chatterer, one of which is endangered. "What about the birds of paradise?" I asked. "Of course," he wrote. "I can't enumerate it all, but he had everything." Heart thumping, I asked him if the skins still had tags on their feet. After a long pause, Delisle replied, "Oui." When I asked if I could see them, he told me he'd get back to me. Instinctively, I returned to Delisle's Facebook page and pored over hundreds of photos of flies, hooks, and bird skins in search of more evidence. I texted McLean an image of 3 full Indian crow skins surrounded by 8 severed and plucked breastplates. All that remained where the fiery orange feathers once shined was a leathery expanse of dried skin. "That's a lot of empty shell casings," the detective texted back. "Must have been quite a gunfight." Delisle didn't appear worried about raising suspicions when displaying his collection. There was a superb bird of paradise patch in one photo. Another showed skins of all 7 species of blue chatterer, next to feathers from cock of the rock, western tragopan, and 2 different subspecies of Indian crow. All the plumes were neatly fanned out on a large patch of polar bear skin. If I could prove that the birds he'd purchased from Couturier were from the Tring, I could potentially cross 20 birds off the list of missing skins. But I soon made the discouraging realization that Delisle had an eBay account. If these were Tring birds, they were already gone. Under the handle BobFly2007, he sold flame bowerbird plumes for $19.99, resplendent Quetzal for $43 a pop, Indian crow feathers for $139, and the full skin of the endangered Cotinga maculata for $417.50. Combing through over 2,000 of his completed auctions, I logged $11,911.40 in feather sales, giving eBay a commission of over $1,300. As I read through his customer reviews, "Excellent to deal with and very personable service," and "Thank you for the fast shipping," I wondered how eBay could permit such flagrant violations of CITES and other wildlife trafficking laws. But the Delisle sales were small potatoes compared to other feather vendors I started unearthing on the auction site. A simple search for flame bowerbird, the species hit the hardest by the Tring theft, brought me to Doug Millsap's auction page, which he ran under the handle lifeisgood.503. A pair of feathers were priced at $24. When I noticed a full skin in the background of one of the auction photos, I messaged him, feigning an interest in buying the whole skin. He said it was mine for $1,800. While the flame bowerbird is not a protected species, it was not a commonly available bird in the fly-tying world prior to the Tring heist. "Most of these are part of a collection from the 1920s Victorian era," Millsap wrote, encouraging bidders to "check out my other auctions for rare and hard-to-find materials." Based in Ocean Park, Washington, Millsap manages a pizza parlor with his wife, but he advertised a surprising amount of rare bird skins and feathers. Between 2 separate eBay accounts, he had so many seller feedback ratings that I had to hire a research assistant to import the data into my spreadsheet. "A gorgeous vintage scarlet macaw sold for $490, a blue and gold macaw for $650, and a full blue chatterer skin for $1,675. As the species began to appear in row after row, blue chatterer, 12-wire bird of paradise, penguin, Banksian cockatoos, the tally of revenue quickly cleared $80,000. Though eBay's wildlife and animal products policy advises its users to follow international treaties like CITES and domestic laws like the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, the company appeared to be doing little to preempt or monitor for illegal sales. It wasn't as if Delisle and Millsap were using code words to describe the birds. Many listings used the birds' Latin names, which would make it easy for eBay's screeners to surface the posts, if such screeners existed. You won't find any rhino horn on the site, but type in the endangered Cotinga maculata or resplendent Quetzal, the sale of which is prohibited by Appendix 1 of CITES, and you can check out with PayPal and have it rushed to your front door by the U.S. Postal Service with an eBay money-back guarantee. I sent several inquiries to eBay, but the company never replied. It wasn't until I sent it a list of hyperlinks to current auctions of endangered bird species and asked how I was meant to interpret the commission that eBay earned in facilitating those illegal sales that they wrote back. Ryan Moore, senior manager for global corporate affairs at eBay, responded within a few hours, sending over a heap of corporate jargon that made me shudder with the memory of the kinds of watered-down statements I had to write as a junior public affairs officer at the U.S. Agency for International Development in Baghdad. eBay is committed to doing what it can to protect endangered species, Moore wrote. The extra words did a lot of lifting. It wasn't that eBay was doing what it could, but that it was committed to doing what it could. eBay has demonstrated a commitment to prohibiting the sale of illegal wildlife products on its site, Moore continued. It wasn't that eBay had prohibited the sale of illegal wildlife products, but that it had demonstrated a commitment to doing so. Moore stressed that eBay had over 800 million listings and provided examples and links to resources with more details about state, federal, and international wildlife laws. He added that the company actively enforces this policy through a rules-based filtering system and reporting mechanisms available to eBay members and government agencies, and through removal of products and/or sellers as appropriate. When I asked how the filtering system worked and whether he could provide statistics on the number of auctions that had been halted by eBay, he was unwilling to share. I drew his attention to a listing of feathers from Caatinga maculata, an endangered and protected species. By listing it under its Latin name, the seller had made no effort to keep a low profile, making it clear that whatever filtering system eBay had in place wasn't populated with terms from the International Union for Conservation of Nature's Red List, the central database of threatened species. Moore promised to look into it. When I refreshed the Caatinga auction page, it was gone. But this was obviously damage control. Instead of flagging something with a press officer, I was curious to see what happened when I used eBay's online form. I reported an illegal auction of a pair of resplendent quetzal feathers, but a week later, with no action by the company, they sold for $39. Delisle had gone silent. After years of picking off names one by one, I decided to make one public post in the forum, challenging the entire community to help me find the remaining skins. If Edwin was truly just a bad apple in the cart, I argued, why not collectively work to undo the damage to their reputation? The black eye of greed has surfaced again, replied Aaron Ostoy, an Oregon-based feather dealer whose family motto is God, Family, Feathers. I'd first seen his name when he joked about some Indian crow patches being stolen from a natural history museum and sold at 3,000% profit, a full 4 months before Edwin's arrest. Ostoy and others weren't thrilled to see the Tring heist rehashed. Several complained that I was just stirring the pot. One member angrily suggested that if I cared so much, I should donate money from my book advance to the museum. Val Kropenicki called me an ambulance chaser before asking, maybe I'm just sick of witch hunts? Maybe we are all poisoned by this? Bud Guidry, the administrator, was pissed. He said that despite his best efforts, the subject of the Tring heist could only be buried as deep as the shovel handle. He announced that he would leave my post up until it went south. Then I'll sweep it under the rug again till it comes up again later. Shortly thereafter, he wrote that he was being bombarded with private messages from people asking him to remove it. Why were they so troubled? I wondered. I had only asked for help in recovering stolen items to the museum. I had even arranged it so that birds could be returned to the Tring anonymously. Only hours after it went up, Guidry declared that my post would be deleted. The members of this community have spoken. I give you all my word. When another mention of this subject or those involved are posted here, it will immediately be deleted. Guidry told me that 41 members had privately begged him to delete my inquiry. Chapter 25. Feathers in the Bloodstream. Weeks later, when Robert Delisle finally replied, his story had changed. He now said there were no tags. When I asked a question about Couturier, he said he didn't know him. Sensing I was losing him, I wrote, I just wanted to know when you bought the skins from him. After 15 minutes, he wrote, good luck, and never replied to me again. Were the birds Delisle bought off Couturier from the Tring? I was desperate to find out, but didn't even know if Couturier was still alive. Marie-José had found an obituary in French for someone with his name. Unless I was prepared to start searching through the homeless shelters, morgues, and cemeteries of Montreal, Couturier was lost to the story. Marie-José, only a month away from our baby's due date, sensed my disappointment, but asked a clarifying question. What if he's still alive, and he admits that they were from Edwin? Then what? Aren't they all gone anyway? I would know, I guess, I grumbled, suddenly aware of the diminishing returns of my obsession. In the beginning, the mystery of the Tring heist had been little more than a puzzle to distract me from the pressures of my work with the List Project. I'd spent years trying to get people to care about tens of thousands of refugees fleeing a war they no longer cared about. My campaign for a dramatic, speedy solution and an airlift of our interpreters had failed spectacularly, and I knew that I was staring at a lifetime of incremental gains, if I was lucky. Now, as I trawled the web for some sign of Couturier, I realized I was stuck in another endless struggle. I had anointed myself the rescuer of the Tring's birds, even though the museum had long ago written them off as lost to science and wasn't searching for them. With a guilty plea and a closed case the police were no longer investigating, the community of fly tires clearly wanted nothing to do with my quest. The Tring's spreadsheet had been the fragment of a map that launched my expedition, but all I ever discovered were ruins. Of the 64 skins I set out to find, I knew that the remains of 2 were in South Africa with Rohan Neatling. If Long helped Edwin sell 20 skins, that brought it down to 42. If Couturier's skins were from the Tring and Delisle's count was right, then I was down to 22. But I was always too late. Long had already sold off whatever skins he had. Even if I could tie Couturier's birds to the Tring, Delisle had already auctioned them off. Rohan was preparing for the rapture and couldn't care less about my mission. If Edwin had played me and still had them locked away in some long-term storage unit in Dusseldorf, I'd never know. He never spoke to me again after our interview. The only ones I ever laid eyes on were Long's feathers, and I was beginning to worry that they wouldn't be returned to the Tring. Even worse, I had uncovered additional museum thefts by other fly tires. A few years prior to the Tring burglary, at least 2 German natural history museums in Stuttgart and Frankfurt had been robbed of dozens of Indian crow and blue chatterer skins. The thief was believed to have been an older American fly tire who moonlighted as a pest control expert. While spraying for bugs, he'd allegedly taped the skins inside his white coveralls. Marie-José worriedly asked if I was now on the hunt for more missing skins. As more and more museum curators shared stories of specimen thefts, I thought of the 2 currents of humanity running through the story of the Tring's birds. In one coursed Alfred Russel Wallace, Rick Prum, Spencer, Irish, the undercover detective, the League of Curators who had shielded the birds from Zeppelins and the Luftwaffe, and the scientists who probed each skin for insights, adding to our collective understanding of the world in tiny increments. Here were humans bound across centuries by the faith-based belief that these birds were worth preserving, that they might help future generations, trusting that the march of scientific progress would forever present new ways of looking at the same ancient skins. In the other current ran Edwin and the Feather Underground, and the centuries of men and women who looted the skies and forests for wealth and status, driven by greed and the desire to possess what others didn't. In the war between knowledge and greed, it sure seemed as though greed were winning. In the last trip I took before our baby was born, I paid a visit to the battleground of a similar war that had been waged 100 years earlier, the Feather District of New York. The pigeons puttering around on the sidewalk on the section of Broadway that cuts through Greenwich Village barely made way for the humans pounding by in sneakers and heels. The city has evolved around them, mostly upward, but the buildings of the old feather merchants still cast the same cold shadows they did 120 years ago. when 100,000 New Yorkers fashioned the jewels of the sky into hats. I wandered about, imagining great big vats of dye on the upper floors, bulk dealers ruffling through thousands of skins, haggling over the cost per kilo, feather men wheeling new deliveries of birds bagged from the Malay archipelago down side streets, shooing away stray dogs, hoping for something feathery to chew on. French immigrants getting by on the tricks of the Parisian plumassier trade, dyeing and shaping feathers in the tenement house attics of the nearby Quartier Français. Mothers and daughters fluttering down from the Upper West Side to peruse the latest plumed fashions. I stopped in front of the ornate cast-iron pilasters of 625 Broadway, where P.H. Adelson and brother once showcased the latest lines of aigrettes, paradise, and ostrich feathers. Inside, a line of high schoolers waited to order burritos from Chipotle. I'd unearthed the address in an 1899 issue of the Millinery Trade Review, whose editors railed against the mounting success of the Audubon Society and the conservationists fighting to topple their business, condemning them in the name of the free market for attempting to dictate to American women what they shall wear and to American merchants what they shall buy or sell or what they shall import. When the Lacey Act and other early conservation laws were passed at the turn of the century, the men who filled these storefronts with bird skins were beside themselves. "The foolish laws that now exist are obeyed to the letter by the millinery trade," snarled the editors. "Any more of the kind, however, will be strenuously opposed." Behrman and Colton, Max Herman and Company, Velleman and Company, A. Hochheimer's, eventually, all were claimed by the compounding pressures of changing fashions, new laws, and most powerfully, the societal recognition that people had taken their need to possess beautiful birds too far. I crossed Bleecker and stopped in front of a 12-story building that had once housed the New York Millinery and Supply Company, Aronson's Fine Headwear, and the Colonial Hat Company. I'd read about a seizure of a number of bird of paradise plumes here just after the First World War. It is now a PetSmart. A large poster of a parrot near the front entrance proclaims, "Exotic pets in back." In a dark and gloomy back corner, beyond the labyrinth of organic cat food and life preservers for dogs, were four knee-high cages. I squatted down to find 20 parakeets, blue and green. "Choose a colorful companion," encouraged a nearby sign. On the floor of one cage, an orange-beaked society finch, $23.99, or $21.99 with a Pet Perks membership, was standing a bit unsteadily on a pile of wood chips, staring blankly at an aisle of scratching posts. My phone vibrated with a text from Long. He'd recently told me he felt like Tony Stark from Iron Man. In the movie, Stark, an international arms dealer, is injured by one of his own missiles, leading him to change his ways and confront evildoers. Long was excitedly planning to launch a movement called Sustainable Fly Tying, throwing his master tire status behind the use of common feathers, fighting against his community's destructive addiction to exotic and protected birds. I was proud of him, but when he screwed up his courage and finally made the announcement on his Facebook page, his fellow fly tiers scoffed. Jorge Maderal, a Spaniard in charge of a private Facebook group devoted to buying and selling rare feathers, was unmoved. He said he needed to feel the real essence of the feathers and the history. On classicflytying.com, sales of feathers and skins continued. On eBay, it was as easy as ever to buy and sell feathers from protected species. "It's really hard to convince people to quit using exotics," Long texted. He was discouraged. "People just laugh at me and don't really take me seriously." I thought back to something Edwin had told me about his understanding of human nature, that there was an allure to what people knew to be taboo. When I'd asked Edwin why he didn't just use substitute feathers that had been dyed to resemble the real thing, he winced. "The knowledge of its falsity eats at you, and all these people have been eaten by it, including me." The allure was indeed powerful. I remembered the tale of Eddie Wolfer, a fly tier known for owning a live blue chatterer. A couple of years earlier, he had been rushed to the hospital to undergo surgery for a brain tumor. While he was getting a plate installed in his skull, two fly tires knocked on his front door and convinced his girlfriend to sell the bird, which they killed and sold at the next fly-tying show. "That bird was my pet," he lamented in a post to the forum. "Those two SOBs have more money than God. How greedy people can be. You know who you are. I thought you were my friends." I texted Long to see if he'd returned the feathers to the tring. "Soon," he replied. Years after it all began, I found myself back in the Rio Grande River Valley with Spencer, searching for trout. The blue-winged olive mayflies were hatching, floating to the surface to dry their wings, hoping to take flight before being gobbled up. My cast was out of form. I spent half my time unsnagging flies from the pinyon and rice grass on the riverbanks. Spencer, on the other hand, could cast through bramble like a slingshot. Pinching the fly, he pointed the rod tip forward and shot the line through the tiniest of openings. In the half-decade since he first said the name Edwin Rist, the war in Iraq had ended and another had taken its place. I had fallen in love with Marie-José, dismantled the List Project, and moved to Los Angeles. We had a baby boy, happy and healthy, whose eyes light up at the hummingbirds flitting about the feeder by his nursery window. The middle name we share belonged to my grandfather, but also to someone who has become special to our family. Wallace. Spencer and I went for long stretches without needing to speak, hitting a pocket of water, drifting flies into deep pools, looking for a flash below the surface, studying the size of the emerging mayflies. I told Spencer about the email I'd just received from Wallace's great-grandson, Bill. He told me that his 93-year-old father, Richard, had been invited to Tring a few years ago to see Wallace's birds of paradise. When one of the trays was pulled out, it was empty. Spencer clucked. After seeing how the fly-tying community had reacted to my appeal for the missing skins, he told me he felt compelled to become a reformer. He was working on a book in the spirit of Kelsen, but that stripped each Victorian fly recipe of the exotic species that had cast such a dark spell over the community. He was certain that salmon flies could be just as beautiful using feathers that were common and cheap. On the best of days on the river, the life of vibrating devices and glowing screens disappears, and all that matters is the temperature of the water, the speed of its flow, the skittishness of the fish, the accuracy of the fly, and the neatness of the cast. It all felt so pure, so untouched and hopeful. Dr. Prum had assailed Victorian fly tires for desperately clinging to a world that no longer existed, calling them historical fetishists, searching for meaning in the modern world. But as soon as he said it, I knew it also applied in some measure to me. The rivers I fished were dammed right and left. Many were choked with effluent and agricultural waste from industrial mines and farms. Even the brown trout we stalked weren't natural. They had been shipped from the Black Forest region of Baden-Württemberg in 1883 and introduced into our streams. For the right to cast my fake flies to them, I bought permits from state departments of fish and game, which manage hatcheries that raise and release trout into the water. Spencer and I sloshed upstream while a hawk circled high overhead. Smaller birds mobbed it, thrashing at its wing and tail, but it orbited patiently, biding its time. "Got a call from Roger Plurd the other day," he said, knowing of Plurd's less-than-subtle threat years earlier at the fly-tying symposium. "Yeah?" "He had tons of flame bowerbird he was selling." "Really?" "But when I told him that I was about to go fishing with you, he hung up." The bloodhound in me wanted to scurry up the riverbanks and hop on a flight to Plurd's front door, but I knew I was finished. Even if I sent the Tring a definitive list with 500 names of those who'd bought the severed remains of their birds, nothing would happen. The museum had no reason to pursue scientifically useless feathers. On we waited, scrambling over fallen trees, silently gesturing at unsuspecting trout. The chill of the water made our legs drowsy and our boots heavy. But we waded upstream beneath the pinion and ravens as though the river would never end, searching for darting golden flashes beneath the surface. That fall, the men of the Victorian salmon fly-tying world